Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Hello, my name is Elizabeth Carney. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm the host and organizer for tonight's program, which is entitled Heart of the Matter, What Death Can Teach Us About Living Fully. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Frank Ostaseski, in conversation with Courtney Martin. Let me mention a little bit about them. Frank Ostaseski is an internationally respected Buddhist teacher and pioneer in end-of-life care. He is the visionary co-founder of the Zen Hospice Project, founder of the Metta Institute. His life and service has been a fusion of spiritual insight and practical social action. He has sat at the precipice of death with more than 2,000 people and trained countless clinicians and caregivers in the art of mindful and compassionate care. Frank has lectured at Harvard Medical School, the Mayo Clinic, Wisdom 2.0, and teaches at major spiritual centers around the globe. He is the 2018 recipient of the prestigious Humanities Award from the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. His groundbreaking work has been featured on Bill Moyer's PBS series, On Our Own Terms, highlighted on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and honored by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. He is the author of The Five Invitations, Discovering What Death Can Teach Us About Living Fully. Courtney Martin, who we're happy to have as well, has two lifelong obsessions, storytelling and solutions. Courtney is a journalist, author, activist, and speaker. She is a weekly columnist for On Being, a Peabody Award-winning public radio conversation, podcast, and Webby Award-winning website. Her newest book, The New Better Off, Reinventing the American Dream, explores how people are redefining the American dream. She is a prolific writer and author of numerous books that include Do It Anyway, The New Generation of Activists, Project Rebirth, Survival and the Strength of the Human Spirit from 9/11 Survivors, released in conjunction with a documentary film called Rebirth by Academy Award-winning filmmaker Jim Whittaker, and The Naked Truth, Young, Beautiful, and HIV Positive, the life story of AIDS activist Marilyn Brown. She is the recipient of the Elie Wiesel Prize in Ethics and has or will hold residencies at the Rockefeller Foundation's Bellagio Center, Hedgebrook, and the Santa Fe Art Institute. She does ongoing strategy work with TED and the Aspen Institute. Now I would like to have a stimulating dialogue welcoming Frank Ostaseski and Courtney Martin.
All right. Well, that was very generous and unnecessary. We're both now feeling like frauds, right? So I am so excited to be in conversation with Frank. I actually have this like very important relationship with this book. I have the hardcover version. The paperback came out today. When I saw Frank in conversation at the very first Endwell conference, which I know some of us were at together, I was so struck by his presence and his wisdom. And so I read this book very strangely, actually. Reading is kind of my spiritual practice. I'm obsessed with reading. It's what makes me feel grounded. It's what makes me feel inspired. And usually I tear through books and then I don't really remember them that well. And I read this. It was by my bedside stand for a full year. And I would read it in these sort of meditative chunks. And I told Frank this, and I said, it's not because I wasn't totally riveted, but it was because I actually like needed to take it in. And I also found I developed this, what felt like either a fateful or serendipitous relationship with the material, where I would be struggling with something in my own life and then read a chapter or a few pages, and it would speak exactly to what I was struggling with. I have two young children, so I struggle with a lot. And I also have aging parents who both have chronic illnesses. And so I would just like land on a page and just feel like, wow, there he's doing it again. Like he's speaking directly to this thing that I'm wrestling with today. So I was so honored when Frank asked me to be in conversation with him, in part because of this like very real relationship I have with this material. Has anyone else had that kind of relationship with this book? I was curious. Yeah, it's a different kind of book, right? It's you can't tear through it, which I think is a testament to what a gift it is, Frank. So I want to actually get away from the book and start in the beginning. I was thinking about, we talked about, I have a two-year-old and a five-year-old, and they are super interested in death. And I've had these like very visceral, beautiful experiences of seeing them witness death and sort of processing it through their eyes. And so it made me really wonder about you as a child and if you have any early memories of death, and were you drawn to it? I mean, was there sort of seeds of what you would later do in those moments?
You know, first of all, it's lovely to be with you all tonight. Thank you for coming. It's very generous of you to come. And I think it's common for young children, particularly before the age of five, to begin to look at this question. My first love was a lady slipper orchid. I lived on a big country estate, and in this pine grove where I used to wander, I came upon this beautiful lady slipper orchid. And I would go every day to visit her, and she was very delicate and beautiful.
And then How old were you? Do you know?
Probably four or five.
Okay.
And I noticed after the season came, she started to droop. And so I got, as a 4 or 5 year old, I got this forked stick to hold her up. Yeah. But then it really became apparent that she was gone. She didn't have the same vitality anymore. And so I buried her in pine needles. Hmm. And I remember that I was really, it was like a secret. I didn't tell anyone. Though my parents kept asking me, what is it? What is it? What's going on for you? You know? And I just kind of held it, actually, inside. And then, it must have been the next spring, I guess. I would always return to that place and talk to her, even though I couldn't see her anymore.
Wow.
But then the next spring, there she was again. Yeah. And so that's probably my earliest memory.
And you saw that flower as the same one, or did you think of it as...
No, I saw it as the same one.
Oh, interesting.
I definitely saw it as the same one.
Huh.
And I think that's probably my earliest experience of death and regeneration.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Impermanence is not just about endings. It's about things becoming also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm curious about the burying of it. Had you been to funerals? Did you, or was that some sort of instinct?
I think it was some kind of instinct, you know. It was a little bit like putting it to sleep, you know, putting it to bed a little bit. It was putting her to bed.
Yeah.
There was just this kind of naturalness to it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And then did that trend continue? Do you remember other moments as you
did I go around burying things a lot?
Did you go around ritualizing and being like attracted to the idea of
It's interesting.
Honoring?
You know, I think that I don't remember going around ritualizing things, at least not death, but I ritualized other things. And there was a lot of gratitude in my early years.
Hmm.
And it had to do with beauty. Actually, I'm just thinking about that. I haven't thought about this before, so thanks for the question. Mm-hmm. I lived on this big country estate. My father was a chauffeur and drove for a very wealthy family.
Where was this?
Long Island.
Okay.
North Shore of Long Island. And I remember, I must have been six then, seven, wandering out through the woods, and there I found this beautiful octagonal greenhouse. And in the greenhouse, there were beautiful orchids. And I went in. It was like my secret garden, you know, that I had found. And then one day on a visit to this particular greenhouse, a workman came into the greenhouse, and I was just furious as a little kid, you know, and a little troubled by the fact that someone else had discovered this garden, you know. And so I waited until he left, and then I went in to check on all the flowers. But there was a way in which going to that greenhouse was a kind of almost pilgrimage for me. I would go regularly to it, you know, and it was a place of peacefulness and beauty. Hmm. And these days, when I'm with people who are dying or when I'm sitting in meditation, those two qualities, peacefulness and beauty, really characterize the experience oftentimes for me.
Hmm. That's so beautiful. So, and what was your family's relationship with death? What were you explicitly told about it growing up?
Well, it's a bit like sex. Mm-hmm. I asked someone one time, what did your parents teach you about sex? And they said, nothing. I said, well, that's quite a lesson.
Right. Right.
And it's true, I think, around my family and death. You know, when my grandma was dying, it was kept from us. You know, when our animals died, it was kept from us. Mm-hmm. And so that natural fascination or curiosity that your children are exploring didn't get to really breathe and live.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe this is just some early childhood trauma that I'm living out now in my life.
You're going to talk about it all the time to show them, right? So let's shift to teenage years.
No.
Because teenage years are a time when so many of us think we're invincible.
Mm.
And so I wonder, when I was reading the book, my guess is you didn't feel that way for a couple of reasons. One is that your older brother was in Vietnam. And so death was obviously looming, the possibility of death was looming in that regard. And also, as you write about in the book, you were sexually abused by a priest. And you wrote in the book that that felt like he was trying to kill you, that you actually, like there was a certain sort of death feeling related to that experience. Uh-huh. So you, I'm guessing you weren't the kind of teenage boy who thought you were invincible, but actually you were in touch with death in a bunch of different ways.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think like a lot of other teenagers, I was, you know, defended. That's the invincibility, right?
Yeah.
It's the defense. But thank you, first of all, for asking that question. You're the only one who's ever asked me that question. Lots of people read the book and then they say, oh, I was glad you were so personal in the book, but they never actually addressed that issue. So thank you for doing that. Yeah, I was badly abused, sexually abused by a priest for a few years. And it wasn't, it was another secret that I had to keep.
Mm.
And there's anybody who's been through some experience of abuse knows that it's, it is like a death. You know, your sense of identity and who you imagined you were, even, is dramatically challenged. Yeah. And the other thing that was a death for me was that I loved God.
Mm.
And I loved being in church, and I loved prayer.
Right.
And all of those things got decimated, really, through that practice, through that practice of abuse. And but actually, it was a really important part of my life and a big influence for my later work, actually. My parents were also raging alcoholics, and so there was a lot of chaos in my life as a teenager. And I had to get really comfortable with chaos. As a teenager, it was about trying to control it. But really, it was being exposed to it and really knowing what chaos does and how it upsets the equilibrium, so to speak, you know. And I had to find a way of finding some very early on some kind of balance with that. And that was a great gift. That was a really great gift. So all of those things that were so difficult coming home to a crazy household, they became later things that enabled me to build an empathetic bridge to other people who were experiencing those kinds of situations.
Right.
So when I worked on the streets of San Francisco here quite a lot with folks who were dying, and, you know, they lived on the margins of society. They didn't trust much. And so if I was going to be of any use to them, I had to really be real.
Right.
And that meant I had to reach into my own experience, you know. And there wasn't much that they showed me that I hadn't seen in my own life.
Mm.
Yeah.
And when you talk about being real, do you actually mean sharing those stories, or is it more about a quality of presence that you were able to bring because of your own suffering that you'd experienced?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't feel it was necessary to share those stories or impose those stories on anybody. But what do you learn from those stories? That's what helps, from those experiences, not just stories, that enable you to be present, as you suggest, but also unpretentious.
Right.
And available.
Yeah.
Yeah, available with people. To really learn to listen. That was the thing that I really, that so came to me from my youth, actually, was learning to listen because it was the thing I wanted most.
To be listened to.
Of course. Hmm. Yeah, I wanted to be listened to deeply, and I wanted to be rescued.
Hmm.
Every kid who's ever had trouble wants to be rescued.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it didn't come.
But a lot, I'm sure many people in this room wanted to be listened to, right? That's a very common kind of suffering. And oftentimes the way that manifest later in life is talking a lot, right? It's like being the one that
wants to listen to.
So you keep talking till you can get people to listen. But no, but you said it developed listening skills in you, which I'm really curious about, because in some ways you'd think it would have made you, you know, sort of revert to being a big talker and being the big personality in the room, as opposed to learning to listen, to give people the gift you didn't feel like you got. Why do you think that is?
I'm actually quite shy in the room oftentimes with people. I think teachers teach what they most need to learn, you know? And I practiced what I most needed to learn or most wanted, which was to listen, like to be listened to, you know? And so, golly, you know, when someone's pouring their heart out, what else can you do?
Yeah.
I mean, can you really just actually be available to people? You know, we're so busy trying to fix everything, huh?
Mm-hmm.
We got some problem, somebody's got a problem, we've got a solution for them.
Right.
And, you know, usually those solutions don't work, you know? And even if they do, the best solutions are the ones that come from the person themselves.
Right.
And so if I can really listen in a way that inspires them to listen to themselves,
right,
then they will find the solutions that most serve them, I think.
Yeah. But how did you learn that? Did you, was there a great listener in your early 20s or something that you started to, because it sounds like you didn't get it from family life.
No. I mean, later in my life, I had wonderful teachers who listened beautifully, kindly to me. I think I started to see what the effect of listening was on others. And not only on them, but what the effect it had on me.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that was really the teacher. Yeah.
And it became kind of seductive because you were like, oh, wow, this is
It became
powerful.
The thing I, yeah. well, it was, you know, we all develop skill sets, right? And we also develop something that, you know, usually those skill sets are developed around something our heart really wants. So, yeah, I think seeing the effect on other people and the positive effect, it became the ground, the first ground of compassion, yeah?
Mm.
And compassion is always about turning toward our suffering, isn't it? And so that learning to listen was, in fact, just that.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's so beautiful. So then you started to really work on the front lines of kind of this death and dying space during the AIDS crisis, right, in the 80s in San Francisco. And then in 1987, co-founded the Incredible Zen Hospice Project, which is, as anyone who's read the book knows, is the source material for many of these beautiful, truly incredible stories. So talk about that time in your life. Like, as you were getting involved in that work, did you see the seeds of some of the wisdom of this book being planted, or were you just kind of living your life? And I mean, were you taking notes of some of these patterns? Or?
No. In fact, I hesitated writing a book at all, even now. I only did it because my wife made me do it.
Goodness she did.
She did. Yeah. It was really her idea, and I'm really grateful to her. No, one of my early teachers and mentors and then later friend was Stephen Levine. And Stephen was a dear friend. And we used to hang out a lot together, and he always encouraged me to write things down. And I said, Stephen, this story is so alive. It's impossible for me to forget this story. So when it comes time to write, I'll remember them. It's impossible to forget. Well, that was a ridiculous idea. That was a really silly idea. I forgot a lot of them. You know? I didn't know what it was like to get older. Yeah. So there was, I think that I sort of like oral history. And there's something about telling a story a few times that it really, and I told many of the stories that are in the book many times, and there's something about that really, you know, it's a bit like a myth that way.
Yeah.
You know, you can, the great thing about stories is that you can enter them any place you want and get out wherever you need to. Right? And they're a beautiful way of teaching. Yeah. And so I think telling them a lot really was the way that they kept. And I always felt like I could keep telling the story as long as it was alive in my heart.
Mm.
Yeah. And I've told many of these stories thousands of times, you know, and yet they're still alive. Yeah.
In the process of writing the book, were you surprised by any stories that bubbled up that you never thought were going to be the things you wouldn't forget because you never even realized they were that important?
Some of them I didn't even know. I couldn't remember them until. I'll give you an example. I was when I was a teenager. One of the things that balanced the crazy part of my life is that I taught swimming in a school for severely disabled kids, very disabled kids. You know, I remember Charlie, who could only move his two fingers like this, and yet with floats and things, he could maneuver down the length of the pool.
Wow. Yeah.
And in this, being the swimming teacher there, there was a young girl, Jasmine, who didn't like to get in the pool. She was 16, maybe, beautiful. She liked to flirt with the lifeguard, with me. So she would come to the pool with her class, but she wouldn't get in the pool. And so I felt like my whole job, and I don't know how I knew how to do this, was just to hold a mirror up to her and remind her how beautiful she was and how bright she was and how courageous she was.
Mm.
Yeah. And so then she'd come, you know, after about a few months, she'd come and she took off her heavy orthopedic shoes and she'd dip her toes in the water and sort of kick her toes. And each time I would reflect to her her beauty. And her loveliness, you know. And then after several months, I can't remember why, one day I saw her come out in her wheelchair in her turquoise bathing suit, and she rolled over to the side of the pool, called me over, slipped out of her wheelchair onto the marble slab and jumped into my arms like a 7-year-old.
Wow.
And I didn't remember that story until I was writing. And then I remembered this part of what I said earlier, that there was a part of me that wanted to be rescued when I was younger by love.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we want to be rescued by, love. But love did rescue me, but it didn't come from outside to me. It came from within me. And it was in the expression of that love that I was saved, actually. Mm-hmm. And I learned in that experience with Jasmine that sometimes, like the poet, you know, Galway Cannell says, sometimes it's necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness.
Hmm.
Yeah. And that when we feel we're beyond love, which I certainly felt as a teenager, it doesn't help that people just tell you that you're loved. You have to show people that they're loved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that experience working with the teenagers became the ground for me in my work later in hospice work. Yeah.
Hmm. That's right.
And I didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a good job. I just got a job as a teenager.
Right.
You know, working in the pool. But there was something again about listening and beauty, which I always felt like they were guides for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were guides in the back of my mind and heart, showing me what to do. Yeah.
Mm.
I don't know.
I'm curious listening to that about, you know, you talk about you wanted to be rescued, and so many of us want to be rescued by love, and then you figured out that the love came from you. And in that story, for example, you're kind of the rescuer, right? But one of the things you write about in here that I also really identified with was not getting addicted to being the rescuer, not getting so identified with this idea of, you know.
So I would say I wouldn't say that the love came from me. I would say the love came through me.
Through you, yeah. Yeah.
And that's really different.
Hmm.
And that's one of the distinctions that keeps you from being a rescuer.
Hmm.
One of the things that leads us to being a rescuer is, then, first of all, imagining egoically that, or narcissistically, that we're the one doing it.
Right.
You know, and that's a foolish notion, I think, for many of us. I don't know how to rescue people, actually. Mm-hmm. I know how to be with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I really trust their own hearts will be reliable guides, in a way.
Hmm.
But yeah, I think our healthcare system is rampant with rescuers, you know. And, you know, we think about, why do we go to help somebody? You know, some of it's a natural compassionate action, right? Somebody's hurting, you reach out in the darkness and care for them. That's what we do, right? Well, that's the right attitude with which to address suffering.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's another attitude, which is that we help people sometimes out of our own personal distress.
Mm.
It's too hard for us to see them suffering, so we want to do something to them, yeah? And so we give them more chemotherapy, or we give them our advice, or we do something like this to alleviate our personal distress with their suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So at some juncture in this, you have to get comfortable with suffering.
Mm-hmm.
You have to realize there's a value to suffering even.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean martyrdom, and I don't mean that it's all great, but that there's suffering. Anybody not have it in this room? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or anybody not struggle with witnessing it. I mean, I think as a parent and as a daughter, that was one of the things that the book kept showing up for me as, was like the witnessing of people I love suffering and not.
So what happens for you when you notice this with your daughter, for example?
It's,
with Maya.
Yeah. So I have two. I have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. So it feels like a very visceral reaction of wanting to stop the suffering, and I have to kind of talk my way through that. Some of that suffering is the only way she's going to grow, or they're going to grow, is through figuring out their own coping mechanisms and understanding that other people suffer, and the way you're feeling right now is how other people sometimes feel, and that this is like a inevitable experience. That.
So what do you do when she's suffering?
Drink a beer on my porch.
Good idea.
I'm thinking about sleep training. I definitely had to vacate the premises for anyone who's survived sleep training, which is a form of
really,
acute suffering.
That's a really good example, like, when you hear your child
crying. Talk yourself through it. But I think these days, especially with my 5-year-old, when the suffering is more complicated, there's a lot of me trying to just kind of keep the forest for the trees for myself, sort of breathing in that moment and kind of talking to her calmly. But also it develops this like very deep empathy for all humans, because I'm like, oh man, like she's 5. So she is just expressing her suffering in its purest, rawest form, because she doesn't give a shit what anyone else thinks. And it really puts me in touch with, like, this is how much suffering everyone is walking around. Like, that all adults are 5-year-olds who've like learned to, you know, compartmentalize and do all the other things. And it makes me just profoundly impressed with all of us. And I'm like, I mean, of course, some of us still throw tantrums, but most of the time adults, you know, deal with a lot and a lot of challenging feelings. And watching a 5-year-old has given me empathy for how much.
But I imagine that for you, because you're a good mom, that you also surround her with some kind of love when she's suffering, right?
Right.
So when she was learning to walk, and she fell down, what did you do?
Help her back up. Give her a hug. Give her a pat on the booty. Keep going.
Keep going. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So that's the holding environment, right? If a child falls down, the mother or the mothering person picks the child up, holds the child for a while, and then sets her down again. And what happens? She goes beyond her previously constrained, her previous belief about what her limits are.
Right.
And I think that that's, you know, when I teach people meditation, that's how I teach the meditation. Hmm. I say, let's create a loving environment. Let's not live with our preconceptions about, you know, what we think we're capable of. Mm-hmm. Let's not be limited by that. And the same is true in the room where someone is dying. I think our primary work is to create a loving, holding environment in which whatever needs to happen can happen.
Hmm.
Yeah. And what happens when you do that is that people discover their capacity.
Right.
And they can go beyond. Just like your child can find more steps, we can go beyond our notion of ourself as a purely separate, troubled self.
Or some idea that it's not fair and it shouldn't be this way. I mean, I have a very distinct memory of my own father saying to me a lot, "Who told you life was fair?"
Yeah.
And I remember kind of, you know, but I think about that a lot now, because it's like that is one of the lessons of suffering. It's like, you know, that this is a universal experience. And I don't do you any favors as a mother by protecting you from being in touch with the fact that, like, sometimes life
and hurts. It is suffering, and we can hold. And
right.
we can
right.
I had a heart attack several years ago now, and in the recovery, it was really difficult. I thought I knew everything about dying. I realized I didn't know beans about dying. You know, it's a different view from the other side of the sheets.
Right. I was just going to ask you about this, actually. This is my next question.
Oh.
Yeah, it's like, what did you learn from being on that side of things that you never could have learned?
Well, I just realized how overzealous I was in all my knowing, you know. Mm. But there's a story in the book that I share, which is a very famous Tibetan teacher called me up to wish me well, you know, when I was recovering at home. And I was having a horrible time at home. I felt helpless and dependent, and I thought I was irrelevant, that I would never teach again, that, you know, my identity was disappearing. Yeah. And anyway, this very famous Tibetan teacher called me up, and I thought, oh, he's going to know, you know. He's going to give me the practice that's going to steer me through. And so I got on the phone with him, and I said, how'd you deal with it, the depression and the beauty and the pain and all of that? You know, what'd you do? He had a heart condition, too. And it was a long pause, and after a while he said, well, I think it's good to have a heart. And he said, And if you have a heart, you should expect it will have problems. And then, you know, he told me to rest more and he hung up. That was it. No great esoteric practice, no nothing. Just, and after I got off the phone, I thought, he's right, you know. If we have a heart, if we have a human body,
right,
we should expect that we'll have problems. I mean, who told us otherwise?
Right.
You know? Except
yeah,
if
I mean, when you actually think about the fact that human bodies work as well as they do as much of the time,
yeah,
it's like flabbergasting.
They're either
like,
amazing or totally undependable.
Right.
I don't know how to hold them sometimes.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, the fairness piece is something else.
Hmm.
My friend Rachel Remen and I teach together a lot, and she has this exercise she does with people in the room like this, and she says, do you all remember sometime, what was the first thing you remember caring for? Like for me, it was the lady slipper orchid.
Yeah.
And we asked people in the group, and they all get something, and then we say, okay, how old were you? Were you 10 or 12? About two hands go up. And then we ask them, how many of you were 7 to 9 years old? More hands go up. And then we ask them, how many of you were 5 years of age or younger? And all the hands go up in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, those are caregivers. Those are healthcare practitioners. That means the seed was planted a long time ago for their work.
That's so interesting.
Now, Rachel and Jack Cornfield, my friends, were teaching at Hastings Law College once, and she thought she'd do this exercise. She did the exercise. No hands went up in the room. And Jack leaned over and he said, ask a different question.
Yeah.
and she said, oh, ah, this is about fairness.
Right.
And she asked the whole question about who did you defend
sticking
when you were young.
Sticking up for someone or
exactly.
Something. Yeah. Interesting.
And boy, then the hands went up in the room.
Wow.
So I think these seeds are planted really early in us, you know.
That's
and,
so fascinating.
And I've given up trying to figure out my road, you know, meandered. I it wasn't a straight line to get me where I am now.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
I want to bring some of your words in here because they're so
okay.
Beautiful and we haven't read any words yet. One thing you wrote was, death is not waiting for us at the end of a long road. Death is always with us in the marrow of every passing moment. Mm. She is the secret teacher hiding in plain sight. Mm. She helps us to discover what matters most.
Mm.
So that phrase, the marrow of every passing moment, I have sat with a lot because I find it so interesting because it means even as we sit right here in this room, right, in this moment, here's the marrow, like what would we be doing differently or are we doing it? Are we doing it right? No, I don't mean are we doing it right, but what even sitting here and listening, how would we listen differently if we were really in touch with?
Yeah. I mean,
death.
I sat down here in the back of the room and Gary, who's back there, there he is, just turned to me and said, thank you for the book. He said, if I may, he said, my wife died suddenly, you know, several years ago now. And my life became so vibrant as a result of this experience. Like, wow. I didn't want to waste a moment, you know. Mm. And he said, now it started to fade.
Mm.
He said, now your book has helped me regain that vitality of life. Yeah.
Mm.
And I think that's a common experience. It's easy for us to forget.
Yeah.
You know, like I always say, we think death is going to come later. How many think death will come later? Yeah, right. So later gives us a comfortable buffer between us and death. But impermanence isn't later. Impermanence is now. Everything is constantly changing now. And I think when we align ourselves with the truth of that, you know, then, you know, the fact that life is uncertain, this, you know, we start to see that this is part of the experience of life and it doesn't need to frighten us.
Mm.
You know, it encourages us to really use our life fully and completely. So I think that constant change is there all the time. You know, I was at a dinner for Silicon Valley types. And they were all heads of companies and smart people. And I said at dinner, death is inevitable. And a guy raised his hand immediately. And he said, you know, we're working on that, mm-hmm. you know. And I said, okay, good. When you get it, you know, let me know. But I said, let's take the word death out of the sentence. Let's just talk about endings.
Mm-hmm.
How do you meet endings?
Mm-hmm.
Like the end of tonight. Like, do you leave before the event's over? You know, do you start making a laundry list about all the things you got to do tomorrow before this? How do we meet endings? The end of a meal, the end of a sentence, the end of a day. Yeah. How do you meet endings? You want to prepare for death? That's a really good practice. And so it's always here, these endings. And they're not, they don't just fall off the end of a cliff and that's it. Boom. Every ending gives rise to a new becoming. And you know, impermanence is not just about loss. It's right. about becoming. And so I think for me, anyway, I think that's a really important teaching that helps us care for each other, for ourselves, for the planet, and to function responsibly. You know, I used to use impermanence as a club in my relationships. Like, life's impermanent. Let's not get too invested in this. The poor women in my earlier life. They put up with me. But now it's just the opposite. It's because it's impermanent. I want to love it completely. I don't want to miss a moment. I want to, you know, because we know the people we love will die, that really reminds us, how do we want to care for them now? That's the teaching in every moment. That's the marrow.
Yeah. I think, I feel like, I don't know if other people are struggling with this, but one of the things I felt when I was reading it and when I hear you speaking is part of your message for me helps me say, like, okay, so if it's impermanence, if I can't control it, what a relief. I can just like stop trying to control everything, right? So there's like this lack of control. But then another one of your messages is about like the importance of habit. And if we are really thinking about death's inevitability and caring for the people we love, like we will actually be intentional. And I know there's a difference between control and intention, but sometimes for me, and you know, maybe I'm a little less far along than the rest of you, but those things can get a little muddled when I'm like, like this, one of these beautiful sentences, the habits of our lives have a powerful momentum that propels us toward the moment of our death. The obvious question arises, what habits do we want to create? So then I can get in my mindset of like, okay, what are the important habits? But I can feel that controlling part of me. Do you know what I mean? Like how these two things kind of rub up against each other. How can you be intentional without being controlling, I guess, is the simple way to...
Well, that's a good question. We'll have to practice with that one. But I, you know, the saying that we use, right? Which is, you know, live this life like there's no tomorrow, you know? But, you know, love it like it's the last day of your life, you know? I think we're so busy trying to find black and white answers to these things. And I think life is paradox. And I like to hold the tension of those opposites. You know? I don't feel the need to resolve that in a way. I do the best I can and then I let go. You know, last night I went for dinner with a friend and I thought I would be healthy and I ordered the scallops. And we were having this, there's a meditation teacher friend, and we were talking about deep things like...
Are scallops healthy? I'm so confused about what's healthy these days.
But they were better than the pork chop, I think.
Okay.
So
I'm totally confused about it, so I'm not...
So I had... Anyway, I ordered this meal, and I thought, okay, good, you know. And then about... And the woman said, oh, they're great. And she came back 10 minutes later, and she said, we're all out of scallops, you know. And I thought, I don't even really get to choose about that. So how my notion of control... is really, you know, a bit inflated sometimes.
So what'd you eat?
A salad, I think. It was a salad. It was really boring. But but I'm just meaning that, like, you know, I can decide between vanilla and chocolate ice cream. But the really big issues, like life and death and what happens in those moments, I don't necessarily think I get to choreograph that all the time. But I do get to develop the habit of being fluid and flexible with whatever arises. You know, in Buddhist practice, and I have no Buddhist zeal, we talk about, I call them four flavors of love. They are loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity. Loving kindness is that motherly, you know, wonderful, all-inclusive love. Compassion, you know, we think about this as raising your kids. Like, compassion comes along when your kids go out into the world and they suffer and you have to really... hold them in compassion. Appreciative joy, they do wonderful things, and so you give them your congratulations and your love for that. But then equanimity is something different. That's when they, you know, go out and get in trouble, or they get married, you know, and you have to stand.
Or both at the same time, yeah.
Right. Or you, and then you have to sort of hands off a little bit. Mm-hmm. And in that tradition, equanimity is considered the highest form of love.
Mm.
So when I think of being, having some equanimity with constant change, it's not an indifference. It's not a pulling back from my experience, but rather a kind of warm embrace,
mm-hmm.
of it, but holding the balance of these two things.
Mm.
Yeah.
And that actually, it echoes what you were saying about listening for me, the way you're describing equanimity, right? Kind of a holding of a space rather than a...
Yeah. Like a, you know, we just leap in so quickly.
Yeah.
You know, when I go into a room where someone is dying, my habit is to go sit in the corner. Mm-hmm. I don't actually sit next to the bed. I sit in the corner and I wait to see, is anything really needed before I jump in to help, you know? And I found that that literally, that space, that perspective was more useful than leaning in and, you know, holding the hand and doing all this stuff that the person may not necessarily want. When they want that or need that, I'm happy to do that. But, you know, a little bit more space. You know, when I teach meditation, I say, you know, whatever we can give space to can move. Yeah, whether that's a difficult thought or pain in the body or a big emotional turmoil, if we give a little space to it, it can move.
Mm.
So it means taking that backward step a little bit sometimes and allowing things to be just as they are.
Mm.
And, you know, dying folks taught me that.
Mm. How?
Because I couldn't manage their experience.
Right.
I couldn't control their experience. All I could do was be with it, you know, as tenderly and as real and as honestly as I knew how to do. Yeah.
Hmm.
Knowing that it was not under my control.
Hmm.
It just wasn't.
Right.
And I, back, you know, these, and these days there's a lot of talk about designing our death.
Right.
You know? And we can talk about that, but I sometimes think we might be imagining we have more control than we actually do.
Well, and one of the other things you and I talked a little bit about, because we've both been, you know, I've written about death and dying quite a bit, and I host this NWell conference, and obviously you live and breathe this stuff, that there does seem to be this moment where a lot of people are relating to death purely as a metaphor, you know, like it, they're attracted to the metaphor of it, but the actual visceral realness of it is sometimes feels like it's gotten lost, and you were talking a little bit about, like, you know, like death is messy and physical and, you know, all these things.
I mean, I think it's good that we don't limit our notion of dying, that we use our imagination. I think that's a skillful thing to do. But yeah, death is messy. You know, I'm not romantic about it. It's you know, full of often pain and suffering and vomit and diarrhea and all kinds of things, you know. But also it can be beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It can also be not just tragic, but transformative, you know?
There's the paradox again, right?
Exactly.
We can have the metaphor, but we can't lose track of that.
Exactly. Let's have the metaphor, but keep our feet on the ground, you know?
Yeah.
Praise Allah and tie your camel to the post.
So I'm going to move to you all. And I have a request, which is we really want to hear as many voices as possible in the room. So please ask a question, which means it's usually like a sentence with a question mark at the end. And I will be kind of a bully about it if someone gets up and talks, because we really want to hear a lot of voices. And also Frank and I had this little discussion ahead of time about we really want to hear introverted voices. Because one thing about having a mic like that is it's like all the extroverts feel comfortable like jumping to the mic. So if you're feeling a little more shy, we implore you to be the one to do so. And we will happily, you know, hold the space for you to do so, even if you're feeling a little bit shy. I'm going to just point out, because it feels like my duty as the moderator here, there are 5 invitations. So let me tell you what they are.
Oh, yeah,
so I want you to hear them. So the first is don't wait. Welcome everything. Push away nothing.
That's one. A good one.
I love it. He's like, that's a good one. You wrote it.
I did?
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay. The third is bring your whole self to the experience. Don't leave before you leave, right? Which you were just speaking to. The fourth is find a place of rest in the middle of things. And the fifth is cultivate don't know mind. Which I think is so I mean, just to your point of sitting in the corner and kind of waiting for the room and the person to guide you.
Yeah. So you don't need to have a burning question. You can also come up and just share something that you want to share. Also, that'd be fine. Or you could say, this doesn't make any sense to me at all. Welcome everything, push away nothing. Are you crazy? Yeah. So please.
I'm an extrovert. I'll go quickly.
We like you too.
And I'm a healthcare professional of many years and fascinated by death and dying, been around it a lot. And I just wondered if you ever have opportunity to offer courses to medical students or nursing yeah. students or hospitals. It's so needed. It's so lacking. And if you want to come to my hospital in Greenbrae, I'd be really happy about that.
Well, we started training clinicians at Zen Hospice Project, but I also then started the Metta Institute, which is a nonprofit organization which primarily trains clinicians in how to provide mindful and compassionate care to the dying. And when people come, and they usually come for intensive courses, several-day courses at least, it's mostly about unlearning. You know, we got so many habits that we learned as clinicians. And, you know, unfortunately still, it's improving. But still, death and dying, palliative care is not a common part of most physicians' training. For that matter, most nurses' training. In 2016, there was a wonderful survey about this. And 60% of the physicians say that they try to postpone the conversations about advanced directives or pawn them off on the emergency room physicians. Yeah. So, you know, all physicians get 70 hours in delivering babies. But they get almost no training at all in being with people at the end of life. Yeah. I was teaching a big medical thing, big medical center, not what I, anyway, big thing, in Kansas. And the doctors said, you know, they were asking about for families to get more involved in the care of their loved ones. And they said, but they're not being very compliant about this. And I said, really? And they said, what do you think we should do? And I said, apologize. Apologize. You kept them out of the room for so long. Apologize and ask for their help. Yeah.
If I understood her question, you didn't answer something that you could have said that I'm aware of, and that is that here in San Francisco, there's going to be the Coalition for Compassionate Care California.
Yes.
Maybe it's, and you'll be teaching then.
Am I?
Yes.
Okay.
I came here because I thought that's kind of pricey for me.
Yeah. Okay?
But I considered it.
Okay.
So.
Well, yes, that's you're right. I am there, and I apologize for not mentioning it. But I teach all over the world, but these days, this is just an aside. I'm also really interested in teaching and being with members of the general public. I think what we need to do is create, and we're going to create this, a training to teach family members how to be advocates for their loved ones when they go into the hospital. Mm. Not just how to navigate the system, but how to be advocates for their hearts and souls as they go through the system. So we're going to start that up. You come and stick around and keep watching the website.
Mm. Thank you. So I heard a lot today about control and being okay with, you know, lack
yes.
of control.
Yeah.
And I'm remembering when I was a kid, the song Waiting on the World to Change, and not knowing if it was super empowering or super depressing. And thinking about how do you personally become okay with lack of control mm. without becoming, you know, this downward spiral of there's nothing we can do to yeah. improve things.
Well, I raised four teenagers at the same time. That really lets you get lots of practice in being out of control. But I don't think that it means giving up. You know, I don't think, recognizing that we have limited control doesn't mean that we stop standing up against injustice, for example, or that we don't tell climate truth, for example. Yeah. I think that I have to be still sometimes. I have to be really still to know what the right action is. It's not like there's one right action, but what's right action for me? Yeah. And if I'm Heather, you know, helter-skelter, chasing after this and that issue, I won't be very effective, actually. So when I'm facing the difficulties of our world, and there's plenty of them, I think I have to understand two things. One is, in a way, it's perfect just as it is. And that's hard to get. What I mean by that is not that it's good, that it's the perfect unfolding of things based on how we meet them, how we, the habits of our life. And so then I have to be really still and see, what are my habits? What am I contributing to that? And what can I do effectively to shift? Yeah. So I think being embodied, that's the most important thing, yeah? I don't know, most important. It's important to be really embodied, yeah?
What influence or role has any sort of assisted suicide played in your practice with the dying?
Yeah. Well, I don't want to correct you, but I want to make a distinction between suicide and medical aid in dying, of which there's really significant difference. What we know is, you know, remember when I talked to Barbara Coombs Lee, who invited me up to Oregon when they were creating, mm-hmm. it's now 20 years that yeah. that's, that death with dignity law has been in place. And it's interesting, the numbers. You know, I think as of last year anyway, thousands of people have gotten information. Thousands more people have spoken to their healthcare practitioners about it. 1,595 people actually got the medications over 20 years.
Yeah, it's very low.
And 981 actually use the medications as medical aid in dying. That's in 20 years. That's about 49 people per year.
Right.
We imagined it was going to be a slippery slope. It hasn't proved to be that. What I think it has done is help people have some sense of agency and some sense of choice, which enables them sometimes then to meet what would otherwise be unimaginable to them, mm-hmm. unbearable to them. So it's had a certain shock jock effect, I think. Now, that said, the numbers are climbing. And this may be, there may be lots of other factors in this, economics among them. In California, since the law has passed, I think there's about 325 people have actually actively used medical aid in dying. Yeah. So it's a very difficult, challenging question. And I'm always afraid that we are too black and white about it. I think we need a lot of debate on this, a lot of discussion about this, because what we can imagine now isn't the same place we'll be in when we're dying. You know, death will change us. Death will change us. And I think it's good to recognize that. Yeah, I was with a guy this morning who's asking me about medical aid in dying. He was on my board. He's a really dear friend. And he's having a really hard time. And so we're trying to help him figure out how to be with having a really hard time. Can we do that first? And then see.
Thank you. So I don't really know what words are going to come out. I do not have experience being around people who are dying at all. I wasn't there when my folks died. They lived on the other coast. So I was there before and after, but not when. The two people in my life who I'm now closest to had very serious cancers over the last 2 years and survived. So all of us kind of went, whew, okay. And I also practice Buddhism, and so there's this should, like, okay, I should be okay with all this, but I'm not okay with it all, and I don't really know what to do with that, and I know I can just sit with the not being okay with it all, but I'm just wondering, you know, knowing that, just what else you might say.
Well, to be honest, I'm a little suspicious of people who tell me they don't have any fear of dying. I'm not so sure about that, even my most enlightened, you know, teachers and friends. I think this body, this egoic self, this personality that we have, it's always going to be afraid. Yeah. You know, it's built on imitation. You know, we imitate our parents and the other adults in our life, and we create a persona, we create a personality. And we go through life with that. And its primary objective is always to survive. It was always going to be afraid. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Do you ever get afraid?
Sure.
And how do you know you're afraid?
So I'm not sure it's afraid, but I can feel a holding on, a grasping.
Okay. You feel,
it's
it,
like
feel it physically?
It's like grasping to self. I don't know if I feel it physically.
Does your belly get tight? Does your chest tremble? What do you notice?
It's more like I feel confused.
You feel confused in your mind. So you know your mind feels confused. What's your body feel?
I don't know.
Good to look. Right now, what's it like?
Heart's beating faster.
Uh-huh.
I can sense my whole body, feet on the floor.
Uh-huh. Beautiful. So I just want to say that you actually, when you start to explore it, you actually know a lot about what it's like to be afraid. You know, your mind gets confused, you know, what your heart beats faster, etc. So the part of you that knows you're afraid is not afraid. You see that? We can either function from the fear, the reactivity of the fear, or we can function from a place in us that knows that we're not afraid. The fear doesn't have to go away. Yeah? I'm still afraid. Yeah, I'm afraid of a lot of things about dying. I've seen a lot of it. I know all the things that can go wrong. It scares the hell out of me sometimes. But it's not the only thing in the room, the fear. Okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Many of us are probably familiar with Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and her discussion of the stages that people go through in coming to acceptance. My two parts to my question, do you have any comments on her analysis and how do you see those stages? And two, how can we as caregivers cooperate or facilitate the journey that people are on?
It's a great question. Thank you. Elizabeth was a mentor of mine, a teacher of mine. She took me under her wing early on. And so I really admire her work. And I don't think she ever meant those stages as being so linear as they've been, you know, purported to be. I also think they're an incomplete model. The final stage, if you remember, is acceptance. And acceptance isn't necessarily a happy state. If our marriage breaks up, we're not necessarily happy about it. Yeah. So acceptance is a really important state, but I think it's just the beginning of the transformation. In my experience, after acceptance often comes chaos, a deep chaos, confusion. You know, our marriage breaks up and we're thrown into turmoil. And in this, the willingness to stay with that chaos actually gives rise to something else infinitely deeper than acceptance, which is surrender. And surrender isn't necessarily a choice we make. It's a kind of defeat, actually. Hmm. And it's a, you know, my friend John Wellwood died in the last few days. And John talked a lot about surrender and spiritual bypassing. And he and I talked about it as, like, it's not just losing either. So out of chaos comes surrender. Out of surrender comes the possibility for something really different, which is transformation. Transformation isn't just change. Transformation is an entirely different vantage point. We're looking from a different place. Yeah. So I think if we understand that when we're accompanying someone who's dying, we'll understand that acceptance is just the beginning, the really beginning of a deeper, let's call it transpersonal journey that not everybody goes through, but that door is open to everybody who's going through the dying process, even in sudden death.
Hi.
Hi.
So I used to be a hospice volunteer and then became a nurse pretty recently.
Oh.
And
thank you.
The working as a nurse in hospice, because I'm new at it, I think I'm constantly trying to fix things. And I don't find that the actually being there with people is really, really hard.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you had any advice.
Oh, I'm not very good on advice, you know, but, you know, I do like to look and see what's driving it, you know. I think it's useful to see what's driving that particular act. Don't stay there. That particular activity, for example, the desire to fix it, for example. You know, there was a woman that I knew, and she went to see this woman. She'd had read a lot of books and had a lot of New Age training, and she was sitting with Mrs. McGillicuddy and, you know, saying to her, just let go, Mrs. McGillicuddy. It's going to be fine. You know, it's going to be perfect, you know. And every day she'd go into her room and do this, and one day she came to work, and the supervisor said, Mrs. McGillicuddy doesn't want you to come into her room anymore. She said, you've been giving her too many instructions. Yeah. So look and see what actually is hard for you about someone else's suffering. Yeah. And there is hard things about it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we should just run over that. But I think what I find is sometimes what's hard in the other is, of course, what's difficult for me. And when I touch that with some degree of tenderness and mercy, mm-hmm. I'm less likely to try and do something to the other person to fix it. Yeah. And I'll have more confidence in their ability to work with the challenge. Okay? But you're going to be a really great nurse. You know why? Because you started as a generalist. You started as a hospice volunteer with no particular agenda. And that enables you to be with people in a really different way than when you come in with your checklist of things you have to get done. Mm-hmm. So the fact that you had that, really, really value that. Yeah?
Yeah.
Most of the people that are caregivers in this country are not clinicians. They are family members, and nobody taught them to do this. 40 million of them out there taking care of folks. Yeah? And they're just making it up as they go along and trying to be, let their love guide them. So trust your good heart to be a reliable guide, please.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, thank you very much. My question is really kind of a practical one, and it has to do with, we're talking about ourselves and how we're looking at death. And what I have trouble with is when someone I know who dies, what do I say to those that like their loved ones, like yeah. My friend's wife died. And, the things that I've heard, what people say, I'm not really satisfied with. I kind of, have come up with what I like to say. But on the other hand, there's so much more to the what happens to mm-hmm. the death. And I don't know how to address that with those who yeah. are loved ones.
That's a great question. So, there are a lot of cliches out there, Oh, they've gone to a better place. May they rest in peace. All that stuff. Not helpful at all. What do you say?
Well, I say, remember those times in your life when you enjoyed the person's company, you had good times together. And I think that's the important thing. I don't really comment on the death so much as I want to comment on, hey, what do you remember? What do you remember that's good?
I think when you frame it as a question, that's a really good thing to do. Hmm. When you give it to them as an instruction, not so helpful. But when you say, I really don't even know what this is like for you. Can you tell me? Hmm. How are you doing with this? I can't imagine how to do it. Mm-hmm. Well, what are you remembering about your loved one? That's when there's a question like that, then the person can enter it with whatever's true for them. Yeah. And you don't have to be just a consoling one, with the right thing to say. So ask it as a question. I think that's really good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I often think when I hear that someone has died or that someone that I know and it makes me sad, I sometimes say to myself, we're all just walking each other home.
Yeah.
And I think that was Rumi that said that,
possibly.
Ram Dass. Well, I say that because it gives me some comfort. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to know what you say to yourself. What gives you comfort when you see all kinds of things happening? What do you say to yourself to give yourself comfort?
Mm. That's a really good... No one's asked me that question before. Well, it's easy to be glib on these things and sound wise and... I these days, more than anything, I say, I just don't know. And that's not an escape, I actually don't know, The equanimity we spoke of a little while ago, one of the phrases that I use from that are, things are the way they are. And it's not indifference. It's actually a warm, loving embrace. Things are the way they are, And so that calls up in me the capacity, can I meet this thing, the beauty and horror of this world, with some degree of, openness and kindness. I don't think our life is about just, getting born and growing up and, finding the right relationship and a nice house on a pretty street. I think it's about embracing the beauty and horror of this world. I think it's to know that there are kids like my granddaughter whose, mother loves her every day. And there are kids like Carolyn, who work with me, whose mother left her in a dumpster when she was born. And there are kids tonight who are making, tents out of bed sheets and couch pillows. And there are babies crying in Syrian refugee camps. And there are children being shot in our schools, and other children are speaking truth to power. I think our life is about all of that, and that it's possible to hold it all with love and compassion.
Yeah. Wow, that was such an elevated response. I'm sort of embarrassed to ask my question, which is very practical. So I find myself as both a caregiver and as a lawyer.
Oh.
And so I wrote out my
question. That must be a little schizophrenic. Yeah.
I try to merge them, but I
Good.
Did write out my
I'm
question.
I'm only playing with you.
Okay. Here I am. I'm a trust and estates attorney, and part of my job is to help my clients, young and old, well and not well, mm-hmm. prepare all their legal documents, including their yeah. advanced healthcare directive.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
They often want more personal input than the form permits, and so we recommend five wishes and other kinds of wonderful guidelines that they can find on the internet. I also encourage them to write a letter of wishes, which express their own personal point of view, having researched everything on the internet, especially dealing with family members who might or might not want to cooperate or understand and honor these yeah. wishes. Yeah. And so my question to you as a person who has said you don't really like giving advice is what would you, or can you share possibly some experiences that would help maybe all of us in this room express our wishes in writing, parens, comma, right. that's the way lawyers talk, if you think that would be helpful.
Yes, yeah.
What have you observed that was especially not helpful or helpful that might be a good guide to yeah. to go forward? Thank you.
Well, you've given us some really good examples, I think, five wishes documents. But, you know, as an attorney, you also know the limited power of documents, yeah? And so the counsel that I would offer is have a really honest conversation with somebody you trust and assign them as your durable power of attorney, but don't depend on the document to be to communicate everything that you wish. Make sure that a person knows and that there's a live human being who will speak for you, speak on your behalf if you can't do it for yourself. I think that's really essential. You know, documents have their limitations, but human relationships are much more reliable.
Well, before you bang your gavel, Elizabeth, in honor of endings, remember we talked about beautiful endings? It's so funny. The exact paragraph I picked echoes so much of what you just said, but I want to read it because it's so beautifully articulated, and I love when I have the experience of people reading words I've written and I go, oh, I actually like that. Huh. So I want you to have that experience. So
thank you.
Ending with this. To be human is much more than being born, getting an education, finding the right partner, getting a pretty house on a nice street, just so you can sleep, wake, work, go to bed, and do it all over again. It is an invitation to feel everything, to come into direct contact with the strange, beautiful, horrible, and often perfectly ordinary thing we call life. It is an opportunity to be conscious of the fact that some of us will make love while others make war. To recognize the truth that there are babies like my granddaughter born into loving arms and caressed by a mother who kisses her bright future into her child's cheeks. And there are babies like Carolyn, a woman I knew whose parents left her in a dumpster. To embrace the night screams in refugee camps and the giggling of children in living rooms under tents made of couch pillows and bed sheets. There is devastation and hopelessness, and there is passion and holy commitment to creating a better future for everyone. There is me writing and you reading and the separation between us. And there is the unity we feel almost immediately when we are reminded that there is love.
Not bad.
Frank. Right? Thank you, Elizabeth.
And I want to thank this teacher and author, Frank Ostaseski, in conversation with Courtney Martin for their heartfelt comments today. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 116 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.